When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Pantheon Podcasts presents from Hollywood, California, The Devil's Music with Pleasant Gaiman. You are invited to join the Hollywood princess as she explores her lifelong pursuits in the occult, sex, love, and that sinful rock and roll. Ladies and gentlemen, step into the dark parlor of Pleasant Gaiman as she brings you The Devil's Music.
Hey there, this is Pleasant Gaiman, and you're listening to The Devil's Music, a Pantheon podcast. A little bit about me. I'm a punk rock witch from Hollywood, California. I've had a lifelong passion for rock and roll and the occult that started when I was a preteen. In the 70s, I was one of the first punks in LA, and as a teenager, I worked at the Whiskey A Go-Go, started producing shows, and made a Xerox fanzine called Lobotomy, which led me to write for every major rock publication you could think of. In the 80s and the 90s, I fronted three bands. I'm a best-selling author with 8 books out and more on the way. For the past 30 years, I've toured around the globe to teach and perform dance. You might have also seen me acting or dancing in music videos, feature films, and documentaries. Look for me in the new Go-Go's documentary. To find out more about me or to book a tarot reading, go to my website, pleasantgaiman.com. I'm really excited to be part of the Pantheon Podcasts network of rock and roll shows. Everyone here at Pantheon tells stories about the music we just adore so much, each and every one with a different twist. Find them all wherever you listen to podcasts, at Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Pandora, anywhere you get your favorite podcast fix. And head on over to pantheonpodcast.com to share a show with a friend. Or be damned to purgatory forever. Hi, you guys. This is Pleasant Gaiman. You're listening to The Devil's Music. Today, my guest is the fierce and glorious singer for the Avengers, Penelope Houston, one of the first American female lead singers in punk. She's a queen and an icon. Her career's been long and varied, spanning decades. She's done solo work for ages, but now the Avengers are back and kicking. They just got off a Euro tour and are touring up and down the West Coast, showing the youngins how it's fucking done.
Action Alexi.
Hi, I like that introduction. That's awesome. Yes, we're hoping to show the youngins how it's done.
Yeah, I mean, you know, how can you not?
I'm always amazed. I remember 10 years ago or so, maybe more, when I went and saw Iggy Pop and the Stooges playing at the Warfield, and it was his 60th birthday. And I remember seeing him and being like, oh my God, how can anyone do that? Like, when they're, you know, having turned 60 and he's still jumping in the audience and going nuts. And then I passed 60 and now I am, not that I stage dive at all, but I am still doing the Avengers and it still brings me joy. So.
I know, you know what? I can't believe sometimes that like all of that stuff started for us between, like, I mean, for all of us, the collective early punk rock, like around 45 years ago or 46 years ago. It's insanity when I think of that. Like it's longer between now and punk rock than it was when we were younger and the 1920s. Do you realize that?
Wow. Yeah.
Isn't that nuts? It's so crazy.
Time collapses, I guess. It's weird because when you're a kid, things just seem like they're taking forever. And like, when am I going to grow up? And then when you're a grown up, it's like, where did the time go? Where did the years go? What's happening? Especially the last couple of years. I keep telling people, you know, that I left my job at the library a year ago, when it was 2 years ago. So I can't, the last couple of years have really accordioned into some kind of strange, you know, shrunken time period because of COVID. So, yeah, time has always been odd and it's just getting stranger.
Yeah, I think it's just totally bizarre. And I completely still remember like so many scenes from like early punk rock, like it goes through my head like a movie, and I can remember what like everybody had on, what everyone was doing, who was playing, like what happened, and I mean I have that with other periods of my life a lot, like flashes of it, but like just that punk rock, I don't know, it felt like it was such a special time and such a unique and wild time that will never ever fucking get repeated, because that was, I think, like the last time that anyone could do anything in quote, quote, youth culture and not have it just immediately co-opted, you know?
Right. Yeah.
It was so free rangey.
They were actively uninterested in us and co-opting our scene. It was like nobody got signed. I think the Dickies were the first band to get signed, but
they were, and everyone was really happy for them down here.
Yeah. But I think one of the good things about that is that people had to put out their own 45s. Nobody could really afford to record an album and then put it out an album. And that meant that of all the bands, you got the two or three best songs of that band on a 45. It was kind of crystallized and distilled into the best of. And nowadays people can just sit in their bedroom with their guitar and record an album and then put it on the internet the next day. You know, it's kind of like unedited, you know, hasn't faced the test of fire.
Yeah. Or like, I mean, also, especially lately, like a lot of people have not been playing out that much because of COVID, or at least, you know, for a while they weren't, you know? So if it was a new developing band, you couldn't even like rehearse during that time, which is crackers to think of.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So hard for people.
Do you hang out with a lot of young people or a few young people?
I don't know that many young bands. I have a few friends that are younger musicians in the Bay Area, but I don't know a ton. But since you brought it up, we're actually, we've got some young'uns coming up on stage and singing with us. a couple of members of the Linda Lindas are going to jump on stage in LA and sing Teenage Rebel and one other song with the band. So that's going to be super fun. They're kind of inspiring. I love them. I love their spirit. And there's some people in the Bay Area that I like, but not, I don't know a ton of new bands, I have to say.
I don't know a lot of them, but I know a few of them around here in LA. And the ones that I know, like, are really cool now and would have been, like, really cool back then. It's got the same kind of spirit, not necessarily the same sound or anything, but just, like, really cool, interesting stuff. What was it like when you were just in Europe? Who were you playing with and what was that like?
One of my favorite people that we played with is called Reverend Beatman.
And he's, oh, I know who that is.
Do you know Reverend Beatman?
Oh, yeah. Totally.
He's not young. He's older.
No, from the Miracle Workers. I knew him from them.
He's amazing. He played with us in Hamburg. And we had a great show. And he was mesmerizing and disturbing and his stuff. I got their new album. I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet. And there was this band in Dresden, an all-girl band called the Ad Rats. And they were really amazing. But they sang everything in German, so I'm not really sure what their lyrics were like. But they just switched instruments whenever they wanted. And there were a bunch of different people singing. And you could tell different people writing the songs. I love them. I don't know what will happen. I'm not sure how easy it is to be a brand new band in Dresden. But they were great. And then some of the people I saw we played Rebellion, which is in Blackpool. And it's...
It's a what?
I don't know. It's in its 15th year. It's a gigantic 3-day punk rock festival in the UK. And I got to see Polly Murray of Penetration. And we'd played together. The last Avenger show ever, I think, was with Penetration. One of the last shows back at the old Waldorf in 79. And then the woman who, she was in the Raincoats, and she sang and played guitar, and she kind of blew my mind. I posted a little short clip of her playing solo there. And then there was, like, you know, a bazillion big punk rock bands and English bands and stuff. And there was a one all-girl band that was Korean, and they looked really interesting, but I don't know what they sound like. That was a bit of a blur. And I don't remember the Nervous Triggers, or Nervous Trigger, was a band we played with in New York that was very funny. It reminded me of the Weirdos.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And on the tomorrow night, well, not tomorrow night when this podcast comes out, but the LA show that we're doing, we've got Elvez doing his tribute to the Screamers, which I'm just dying to see. And then before that, there's a new band called, or newish band called Rugburn. And they remind me of the Suburban Lawns. There's a couple women in the band, but just the way the songs are and the way the singer sings just reminds me of the Suburban Lawns, which were kind of, nobody ever did what they did. Nobody could ever do that. It was just, they were so unique in their
time. That was like a total quote art band, prototype band. There was kind of a lot of that going on in LA with like the Deadbeats and just some other crazy ass experimental sounding stuff.
Yeah, but I felt like Sue Tissue was really unique, her singing style and
lyric stuff. Her whole presence was so like uncomfortable but really like aggressive.
Yeah,
she was genius. So let's let's talk about your early days of punk, but I think we got to take a little break first. So we're gonna listen to some music here, and I will be right back with Penelope Houston. Hi, Penelope and I are back. So, didn't you move from Washington to San Francisco to go to art school?
Yeah, I grew up in, partially grew up in Washington State and near Seattle. And then I was going to school in Bellingham.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a kind of a hippie school up there that I went to when I was 16 years old. And then I came back to Seattle and I met the Tupperwares, who became the Screamers, and hung out with them for a little while. And then I got into art school in San Francisco. So I moved down to San Francisco on the dawn of 1977. It was like New Year's Eve of 70, beginning of 77. And as soon as I got there, I was trying to, you know, focus on my art and my painting and school, but the whole thing was starting with the Mabuhay Gardens and crime, and the nuns were playing and just started going out. I guess at the Mabuhay, because they had a kitchen, you could go there if you were 18 or
yes.
older. So we all got in there when we were underage. I'm sure shit, there was some underage drinking going on.
Oh yeah, that was like the whiskey down here too, because of the kitchen thing.
Yeah. So started going there, and then pretty early on, like May perhaps, these folks from Southern California were up there, Danny Furious and Greg Ingram, and they were starting a band and they needed a singer. And I just came into their rehearsal place and got behind the microphone while nobody was around and put on some records and started singing, and I fell in love with the amplification and just being super loud. I was like, I'm gonna be your singer, I can do this. And they're like, okay. And then after a little while we found Jimmy Wilsey and we started playing the MAB, and I think our first show was in June of 77. And yeah, from there it just kind of blossomed. And we loved coming to LA and Hollywood because those guys were from here, so they knew a lot of people. And I think there were people in Hollywood that pretended we were an LA band.
Well,
that rumor has persisted.
Really? That's crazy. I never heard that, but I guess it's because I knew you were a San Francisco band. But the first place, well, first of all, I didn't realize that you'd known Tomato and Gear from when they were in the Tupperwares. I had no idea. I just knew that the Screamers knew like everybody who was cool. And I was like, how did they figure out the Avengers before anyone else did? You know, because I remember meeting you at the Screamers' house and I thought you were so incredible. And so beautiful too. And I also, this is going to sound so sick. I was telling my lobotomy cohorts, Randy and Teresa Carigas, I was saying like, she should have a baby with Billy Idol, like as though like the peroxide would carry on in you guys' gene pool.
People just always called us twins, me and Billy Idol.
No, but I mean, really, you know, it was the haircut one and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I was back in 75 when the Tupperwares were playing in Seattle. I dressed, everybody would just dress up for all the shows. And I dressed up in this kind of, I had my hair slicked down and like a little mustache on. And I was wearing a brown shirt or something very, you know, I don't know, Eagle Scout or like
SS. Eagle Scouter. Yeah, I was going to.
I was their bodyguard. I was just trying to look tough. And I was like their teenage bodyguard. There's a hilarious photo of me and Tommy Gear from that evening, from that show.
Oh my
but
God,
they didn't do very many shows. It was, the scene up there was really pretty tiny at that time. So I guess it wasn't that hard to find them. And then when they moved to LA and I moved to San Francisco and started, we started the Avengers. The first show that we did was in a warehouse and we were just doing cover songs. And then I think like a week or so later, we had our first Mabuhay show. And during that week, I came down to LA and I was hanging out with Tomato and Tommy. And I told them about it. And they said, that's great, except you need to write all your own songs. You can't do cover songs, which is funny because they did a few cover songs at the time. But we came back up and we wrote like 5 songs for that first show in a week. Some of which survived and some which did not survive. But they were a direct inspiration for the Avengers becoming original songwriters.
Otherwise, you'd be doing like Where the Boys Are. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I think we did Pissing in a River and Vicious by Lou Reed and so a Kinks song. Maybe a Rolling Stones song. I can't remember all the covers, but yeah, you know, it wasn't bad stuff, but I saw their point in writing original music, the importance.
Well, when your EP came out, when the Avengers EP came out, it happened a few other times, but not every time. Everybody in LA was listening to it at the same time. I mean, not everybody, everybody in the punk scene. Like it happened.
The Danger House EP?
Yes. And it wasn't, it wasn't just because it was from Danger House. It was like that happened. There was a point when like when the Clash's first album came out, you could hear it coming out of every window in the Canterbury, and it's like, it might as well have just been on one loud speaker, except that you could hear different songs going on from when someone put the record on, but that was, everyone was listening to you guys' EP. And, Danger House was so great when you think of the amount of stuff and whose stuff that they put out. It was incredible.
Oh yeah. And the other thing is they just started the label and started putting stuff out. It wasn't like a big deal. It was just like, you know, we're going to do it and we're going to make this many records and try to sell them and stuff. And nowadays, just even getting a record pressed seems like it takes 3 years. And then getting it distributed is impossible. And it was such a different time. I mean, word of mouth was so important to getting records out there and into stores and such.
Yeah.
Nowadays, totally. It all seems so hard. Like anyone starting a record label has got to be either a billionaire or crazy.
So, yeah.
And they were just a bunch of guys from the Midwest.
I know, totally. KK and Rand McNally, Pat Garrett, they were both like from Kansas or Arkansas. I can't remember. Somewhere. Yeah.
Somewhere out there.
Yeah. And they're in, as they used to call it, Indian territory. No, like they were just, but they I don't know that the stuff that they put out was so cool. And everyone that we knew that was putting records out, no matter how they were coming out, was so great. It was really such a free for all creative time that like, I don't think that'll ever happen again like that, you know, because there was built in audience, even though it was small. And then like, you know, people that you knew worked at record stores and they would just order it. And then, you know.
Yeah. It was seemed like a much more innocent time, really. People had energy and they would start stuff. And I mean, you still get that feeling, like if you go to Smell or some of the, you know, younger bands or people that are starting their own zines and stuff, there's still some of that energy around, but it does seem like the world has just gotten so complicated, you know, with the internet and people self-recording and stuff. It's just like there's so much out there. It's so dense. And back then, you just look for a flyer on a pole and then you knew where you were going to be on Friday night.
Totally. You know? But it used to shock me, though, how sometimes even when there wasn't flyers, like just how everybody knew where a party was at a certain time. You know, like everyone would just show up. Like, I still don't figure out how we did that. Was it like that in San Francisco for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Word of mouth. It was a whole different thing. And the other thing was there were no cell phones. You couldn't text anybody. You couldn't send an email. It just had to be, I guess you could call someone up on your regular phone. Or, you know, the phone down the hall from where they lived, because a lot of people didn't have their own phone, and just say what's happening. And then word of mouth would get out there. But now we can't even imagine going anywhere without our cell phone. Like, what if somebody couldn't make it or they're running late? How would you ever meet up? You know, it just seems insane that we've become so dependent on technology when we used to be able to just follow our nose to where the show or the party was.
I totally agree. I mean, any of that, like I remember, like if I thought someone was cool and interesting, you know, like writing their number down on my hand, or sometimes, you know, like in a Sharpie, you know, like the Sharpies I always carried to make a fake band stamp with.
Yeah.
But sometimes I would memorize some people's numbers that I would call a lot. So I could call them like shitface from just some random phone booth somewhere too.
I know. And now we can't even remember our own phone numbers. Technology has replaced some part of our brains. It's kind of sad.
I know. Some people ask me, if I felt like sad or regretful or missing out that there wasn't social media in those days. And like the first time someone asked me, I said this and it's become like a pat answer now, but I was like, dude, if there was social media in those days, most of us would still be incarcerated.
Yeah. It's hard to, it's kind of impossible to even imagine. We were all social, you know, we had just different methods of communicating because that's what kids do. They find a way.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with 2 devices at once, new quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
So I want to ask you about opening for the Sex Pistols, but before you talk, I just have to preface this with Teresa Carricas, the photographer, just for you guys listening, the famous punk rock photographer, and me and Brad Dunning and Randy Kay and a bunch of other people. I mean, basically there was a mass exodus up to San Francisco to see the Sex Pistols. And, you know, with like a million clown cars, like broken down beater cars full of people going up like that. And so we wound up, we were staying at the Offs house because Kid Congo was with us and, you know, he knew them really well. And we all took acid before going to the show. And so they had a box of kittens and we were coming onto the acid and I could hardly tear myself away from them because they were like baby, like, you know, six week old kittens. And we were so high that there was like a giant line all the way around the corner in front of the winter garden, right?
Winterland.
Yeah. I keep calling it the Winter Garden, like it was that Broadway fucking theater that used to be called that. But yeah. But so there was a line all the way around the corner and we were so high. Like, I don't know about the other ones, but Kid and I just kept walking and just walked right in and no one even asked for our tickets. I mean, we had tickets, but but we just went in and we got in like right before you guys got on the stage. And perfect. You were amazing. I think we walked in kind of a little bit before that, but that show was so fucking nuts. My feet weren't on the ground for most of it because everyone was. I mean, now we know how dangerous that is with all the trampling shit that's gone on at concerts, but also in those days, I think it was a lot safer because people would pick you up if you were falling down or, you know, and also in San Francisco, there was a lot of hippies there at the Sex Pistols show and they were being like really polite about shit.
I remember being quite terrified when I got out on stage and looked out at the audience and I looked for my friends because I knew all my friends were there. Yeah. And I just saw this sea of faces. And then I would spot somebody in that sea of faces. And then a second later, they would have been like, just disappeared. Like, you know, where did they go? It was so crammed together. There's a video of it on YouTube that was shot with multiple cameras. It sounds pretty good. And you can tell at the beginning of that set, my voice has this little like a little bit of a shake in it when I was talking between songs. And then by the end of that set, we were really triumphant. And I did a kind of hilarious version of I Believe in Me, where I'm like, you know, questioning the validity of everyone's, you know, following the Sex Pistols. And like, there's some funny lines in it. And I felt like we had conquered the stage by the time we were done. And then I went out during the Sex Pistols set. I decided to go out into the audience instead of watching from the side stage. And I got out there and it was the same thing. I could take my feet off the ground and not move. And then also I was completely covered in sweat. And it was other people's sweat. It was like, this is too tight. So after a song or two, I just went backstage and watched from the side stage. But that was a moment. I think a lot of people decided to start a band that night. At least a lot of people have told me that started punk bands. That they came down from Seattle or they came from the suburbs or something. They came to that and they were like, whoa, I could do this. Maybe that's what they said. But of course that was the biggest show forever for the Pistols, for us and for just about any punk band. And up until then we've been playing to 400 or 500 people max at the Mabuhay and at a few other venues. But that was a peak moment. think.
Yeah, I mean, that was like a whole huge turning point. I mean, not just because it was the Pistols' last show, which none of us knew, but it was that was like, I mean, I don't even know. That was like the exodus, at least from LA up to San Francisco, was like the scene in Close Encounters where everyone's going from all over, yeah, like to get to the place where the ship is, the mothership is landing.
Yeah. I do remember seeing tons of my LA friends at that show too. It was, but for the Pistols, it was probably a rough situation. I think, you know, I think Sid like OD'd that night or something and got revived, and the other Pistols were disgusted by it, and then it turned out to be, you know, then they were breaking up and all that. So for them it maybe was harder, but for us it was kind of a joyful night, triumphant, yeah, night.
You know, when I was, before the pandemic, I was doing live like storytelling series with called War Stories, and then this would be like Teresa Carigas and I were hosting it, and we would just get a bunch of people we knew on stage, and it was a spoken word show, but no one was reading. I put prompts in a bucket, like craziest gig or getting arrested or whatever. So everyone would just be talking. And then, you know, usually everybody could chime in because they knew kind of what it was about. And when that first one we did, Jane Weedland said this, and I mean, we were and are like best friends for decades, but I didn't even know this. She was, like, Helen Keller was with Sid that night, but like I didn't know that Jane's job was like being the heroin driver to where taking them where they could get like heroin. I had no idea until she said it on stage.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
I know. I don't think anybody did. I mean, those shows were crazy. Maybe we'll bring them back. Now that live shows
that sounds like fun.
They were wild. They were fucking wild. Like just,
yeah.
Because it sounded like all of that stuff, or even the stuff that we're talking about now, like it's normal to us, but like all of us in that War Story show, we kept losing track of what we were talking about, because we would be saying something that sounded like just something we all remembered, you know. But then you look in the audience and see all the younger people's just like their mouths were on the floor. How the fuck did you do this?
Well, I'm really looking forward to Kid Congo's book coming out next month, because I'm sure it's going to be full of a lot of great and crazy stories.
Oh, it's going to be. I mean, it's totally going to be. Kid, like I was in on a lot of them, and they are, I can just attest that his book is going to be pure psychosis in the best way possible.
Well, I've got to read it before the 19th, because I need to have an intelligent conversation with him in front of bookstore, you know, visitors up in San Francisco at Green Apple. And, that's going to be fun, but I need to do my homework. Read it first.
I'll tell you a little bit of a story, like a tiny snippet of one of the stories that's in my book, Rock and Roll Witch. It's right when he had just joined the Cramps. When we came home one night and we were going to take acid to watch like all the old horrifying horror movies that were always in nonstop rotation on TV. And then he said he had to go into my bedroom to use the phone to call Lux and Ivy back, because, you know, they were now, you know, he was just going to be in the Cramps, and he didn't want to call him when he was high. But somehow they found out we were high, and we didn't know this, and we were watching this crazy horror movie. And then I didn't want to say anything because he always thought I was like extremely insane on LSD, which was true. but I didn't want to tell him. I kept hearing whispering coming from outside, and I didn't know if it was on the movie or if it was like some ghost or something. And then I was trying to hold it in, and then he like looks at me and he's like, "Do you hear some weird whispering?" And I was like, "Yes." And it took us like half an hour to figure out that it was Lex and Ivy like kneeling below our windows, like just like making little scratching noises on it and talking because they knew we were tripping.
Oh, that's funny. That's a good one.
Yeah. So anyway, I want to switch into another little topic again. I don't know. Color me dim. Who wrote the songs that were on your first EP? Was it everybody, or was it you, or did you do the lyrics? Or tell us how those.
So Car Crash, I Believe in Me, and We Are the One. We kind of wrote them together. Generally, often Greg would bring some musical chords and parts to the band, and then we would start writing songs. And I think Car Crash, the music from that, had was something that maybe Danny and Greg had written or played in an earlier band they were in. But the lyrics, that was all me. And then I Believe in Me, and We Are the One, we all kind of wrote together. And I think Jimmy wrote a couple lines of that, and I wrote probably most of the lyrics. But I Believe in Me was a song, and still is a song, which just has a chorus. And then I would just make up the three verses that are in the song. And when we went to record it in LA for Danger House, we were at Kitchen Sink Studios, and that was our first recording session ever in my life. So I didn't know how things went. We just got up there, and they had scratch vocals so that the band could be playing and recording, and I would be singing along so they would know where they were in the song. And when we got done with that, someone said, "Okay, now go and do your vocal parts." And I said, "That's it. Just use those." I didn't want to like try to go in again and do it. I was like, "Yeah, whatever you got there, that's the song." And then I think we had like KK and Rand McNally and a few different people singing the I Believe in Me chorus. But those were all our songs. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I had Car Crash going through my head all day today. For real. Who wrote The American in Me?
That was an interesting song. I think Greg brought the chords and parts to rehearsal. And that was a song that almost just wrote itself right away. I wrote all the lyrics and it just came out of me, and it was like, boom, done. And I was like, wow, I don't know where that came from, but there they are. And those are the lyrics. Whereas sometimes the band would come up with music and I'd be like, I'm working on these lyrics, I don't know. And then we would get on stage, we would have a show, and they'd be like, "Let's do that new song." And I'd be like, "Okay." And so we'd have a set list, and in there would be new song, and it would be something. And I would just be making stuff up over whatever they're playing. And one time we actually did a show where there was two places in the set list where it said new song, because I hadn't come up with a title or anything. And I'd just be up there like, "Wah," you know, like just letting loose. But that's not how I prefer to work. I prefer to actually write the lyrics and melody together and have them ready for the band ahead of time. But I didn't know that back in the Avengers days. We just did what we did. And it was usually people coming in and with a riff or a bunch of chords and saying, "This, how about this?" And then I would just start making stuff up. So, but occasionally Danny or Jimmy would have some lyrics, and Danny had a few songs that were mostly his lyrics. And I always know now when I'm singing them, I'm like, Yeah, this is very juvenile. I didn't write these lyrics. Yeah.
So let's talk about when you left the Avengers and did solo stuff, because a lot of people thought that was a humongous departure, but it seemed logical to you, obviously.
Yeah, I didn't just quit the band and then immediately start doing something else. I moved to LA to work with Renee Dalder on the Screamers movie. And I was in Saw That, and I was writing some songs with Renee, and I think I wrote a song with Alex Gibson, who was my boyfriend at the time, and some of my earliest stuff that was post Avengers. But I ended up moving back to Seattle and then moving to London for love and getting married. And then when I was in London, I decided I wanted to write some more songs and tried to get a band together. And this would have been like 82 or something, or 81. And I remember, I think I was 22 maybe, or I don't know, I was 23. I there was a band that had an ad out that they wanted a singer, and I called them up and I said, yeah, I'm interested in, you know, applying for your singer job. And they're like, oh, okay, well, how old are you? And I said, you know, I'm 23. And they said, oh, we're all 22, so that's not going to work. You know, I was just like, what?
Too old.
Remember Carla Mad Dog? She was over there in England, and she was playing in a band called Jimmy the Hoover, which was kind of a one-hit wonder. New wave band of the early 80s.
Yeah.
And she was there, but they had a whole record deal and stuff. And she said they went up to a cabin somewhere in the wilds of England and were doing songwriting and stuff. But I don't know what came of that. But I didn't really start writing songs on my own until moving back to San Francisco. And putting a band together and starting to learn to play the auto harp. So I could, cause I didn't know how to play guitar. The auto harp is easy. You just push a button and strum. So I started writing songs that way. And then I got a band together and was working with them. And then that whole thing kind of slowly built itself up through the 80s until I got signed to Warner's Germany and did a lot of touring over there and had the album that came out on Reprise over here. And it was like a slow build. It took 10 years or something. But I did discover how I like to write songs, and it wasn't how we did it in the Avengers.
Wasn't just new song.
Yeah, new song. And then later, new song. It's like, ah.
Other new songs.
Yeah, so... Yeah, I've kind of developed my songwriting skills and strategies since then.
Well, how does it feel to you now, like being back on stage doing the Avengers? I mean, or like, how do you feel when you're seeing the audience or any of that?
Oh, it always feels really good. As soon as the band starts, it's like the music just lifts you up, and it's so easy for me to do those songs. And a lot of those songs are really still pertinent now, some of the political, more political ones. And it's just exuberating experience for me. And I feel like a lot of people in the audience, that music was a part of their life at different points, and it's important to them. And the people just really enjoy it. So we're having a great time. And Greg and I have been doing it for quite a while now, but not all the time, just, you know, when we can get some good shows. And we've been able to go to Europe a bunch of times and the UK and do the US a few times. We had our biggest tour ever was playing with Stiff Little Fingers. I think it was 30 shows, driving all the way across America, following them. They had a, you know, a nightliner tour bus or whatever that somebody else was driving. But that was kind of fun and exciting because it was a good match for audience wise. But I really enjoy it. It's just, it feels good to me. I'm sure there may be a point where I'm like, I'm done with this. But so far, it's really fun.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems like it would be super fun to do that, you know, like just being with people that you've known for that long, that you know inside out, that you do creative shit with, and then like seeing all how the youngins see it and stuff. I don't know. It just seems like really, really great.
Yeah. Throughout my career, a lot of women have come up to me and said, you know, I started writing songs or I joined a band or I started a band because of you or your songs. And that's always really gratifying. You know, I feel good about that.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, that is seriously amazing, because when you were doing it, there was almost no women, as there had been for like the decades of any other popular music before that, unless it was like, you know, the girl singer in a big band or something.
Yeah. I think there were more women in early punk than there were a few years later when hardcore started.
Oh, yeah.
And then I feel like it was that kind of blew open the doors and anybody was allowed to try anything. And that was one of the exciting things about it.
Yes, I think so too. And it also just disturbs me that sometimes when I'm talking about punk rock to people, they think I'm talking about hardcore. They're like, there weren't any women there. And I was like, no, you don't know what I mean.
Yeah. 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 It was definitely a different time.
Yeah. Was there anything you want to say to our esteemed listeners?
I would invite people to check out the music if they don't know it, or some of my solo music on Penelope.net or Bandcamp. You can listen to all of it for free before deciding if you want to get it or not. And then also, if people are interested in the other artistic part of my life is painting, I have a website, PenelopeHouston.com. That is all my fine art and paintings and prints and stuff.
Oh yeah, we didn't even talk about that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. I've been doing it for a while, and it's something I've been doing more in the last couple of years when we couldn't go touring and all the venues were closed. I started doing more, and a lot of it actually is more of the more recent stuff from the last 2 years is on my Instagram page, which is just Penelope Houston. And I haven't got it all that stuff up on the website, but I've been doing a lot of mugshots. So that's been something I've been using my time for since we couldn't do any shows for 2 years. And I'll get back to it, you know, after this tour's over, I'll get back to some more painting. But that's another thing that I really kind of love and is carried me through the pandemic.
You said, when are you going to write a book?
Well, it's funny. I always thought that I would do an Avengers memoir, and I would do it with the Hernandez brothers who do Love and Rockets, especially Jaime, because his style is so suited to punk rock.
Yeah.
But I never, you know, got it together to make that happen. But I see a lot of people writing, and, you know, it could happen. I could still do that. I might need your bucket of prompts.
I could help you out with that.
But yeah, I'm so, you know, it's crazy because this is, or it will have already happened by the time your podcast is out. But I'm really excited about all the people that are coming to this LA show that I know from different mass. It's like a mask reunion, and I'm really excited about it. It's going to be so great. And that is always inspiring. Like, just, we're playing right now this West Coast tour with Hector Penaloso on bass. Our regular bass player lives on the East Coast and couldn't make it. So he's got so many great stories. You should probably do a podcast with him.
Oh, yeah.
He has a great memory and has a ton of interesting stories. And it crosses from the Zeros to when he moved up to San Francisco, and he was in MCM and the Monster and Flying Color, all these different kind of periods that I was around for. So it's like stories from all over the map, which is great. So yeah, more people, and myself included, should probably be putting these stories down in some form where they can be archived, you know, kept for the world.
No, I know, because they're so good. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I like doing this podcast, because at least people can hear everyone talking about it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I look forward to reading your book, too.
I will also, if you do a memoir
that's more specific to that time, I would love to see that.
Oh, yeah, well. I am going to do that. I've got such a long list of shit to do. I need to look at the cloning. I think that you do too, right?
Yes.
Come on, let's get it together and clone ourselves.
I always, like, I go on tour and I'll, like, bring stuff for doing art and drawing or whatever. I bring my journals with me. And then the tour happens. It's like, when did I think I was going to be writing in my journal or drawing or anything? So
I do that every fucking time. I'm not kidding. Like, I mean, I've been doing that for decades.
Yeah. Yeah. I can barely just get the pictures up on Instagram from the tour like a week later. It's like, here are my pictures from Berlin. It's like, I haven't been there in 2 weeks. but here they are. Like, I'm there right now. And people are like, oh, have a good time. Go here, go there. It's like, I'm home. You know, sorry.
Yeah, I wouldn't have written that book if it wasn't for the pandemic, you know, like that.
That was like,
I was just like, okay, now's the time.
Yeah. Well, that's good. It's been an amazing couple of years with everything sort of stopped and people having to figure out different ways of living. But here we are. We're all still alive. We're still doing it.
Yes, we are. Anyway, you guys, that was the amazing Penelope Houston. That was so good to have you, Penelope.
Yeah, it's really fun talking with you.
Check out her Bandcamp and her website. They'll all be in the podcast episode description. And if you are lucky enough to see the Avengers at any point, do not say no to that opportunity.
Thank you.
All right. It's been fabulous talking to you.
Yes. It's been great. Thank you.
You are so welcome, my dear. I will be talking back at you guys on the next episode of The Devil's Music. And till then, keep on sinning. Keep on having fun. Keep on listening to good music. Bye.
Bye.
The Devil's Music is written and hosted by Pleasant Gaiman. Produced by Aaron Alden. All sound design by Jerry Danielson of Busy Signal Studios. And of course, is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at pantheonpodcasts.com. Our social presence is at Pantheon Podcasts on Facebook and Instagram. Tweet us at Pantheon Pods. All songs can be found wherever you get great music. Please pick up these important and fantastic tracks. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.